Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. If you like Scott Horton shows. Should be a good one for you today. You know, that's the plan. First of all, I'll tell you my website. It's scotthorton.org. I named it after myself, just like the radio show. scotthorton.org. I'm not really an org. I'm actually an individual. But some other guy's got .com. Which I guess is the same thing as .individual. So I'm an org. I'm scotthorton.org. And you can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And that's at scotthorton.org/interviews. And if you want, you can join up the chat room during the show. That's scotthorton.org/chat. Looks like there's a few people in there. Maybe they'll say a few things and take y'all's questions that way. I really should get back into doing the phone setup or something. I don't know. It wasn't really working out that well when I did. Anyway, I don't know. Yeah, we'll work on that. But today on the show, we're going to have Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst. And he's going to be on to talk about Seymour Hersh's new piece in the London Review of Books, which pins last August's Syria sarin attack on the Turks. And he will also be reviewing Seymour Hersh's interview, which is going to be taking place right before Ray's. Now, actually, I don't know. I guess Ray probably won't be listening, but I'll have my follow-up questions for Hersh, and then Ray is going to expand upon what we've heard. I'll tell you now, like I told you then, listen to what Ray says, because he knows things. And he wrote it up. I had a conversation with him on the phone this morning, and he pointed me at this article from back last September, where he and the veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity were pointing their fingers at the Turks and at plans being made inside Turkey for just this type of event. And now here is Seymour Hersh with his giant new story for the London Review of Books, The Red Line and the Rat Line, basically confirming what Ray McGovern had reported in the first place. This is the second one by Seymour Hersh along these lines. So, Cy Hersh coming up on the show here in just a little while, and then Ray McGovern to follow up after that. Man, I have too many notes, and they're such a mess. I hope I can make sense of all this and do a good interview. I really should have ripped this page out and rewrote them all in easier-to-comprehend format. Well, I guess we'll see what happens. I don't know. All right. And now, you know, I was trying to get somebody from the Center for Constitutional Rights or the ACLU, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, why, they're just busy as hell today. And the ACLU, they're specifically busy at a giant conference down in Miami where they're all at a conference. And so, I don't know. Maybe during the break I can go ahead and get Marcy Wheeler or another genius on to talk about all this. I was really hoping to get one of the lawyers from the Al-Awlaki case. This came out, I think, Friday afternoon after the show. I forget now. But anyway, yeah, I think so. I think it was after the show Friday. The news came out that a judge had ruled that if the president murders an American citizen with a remote control plane in Yemen or I guess anywhere else, that it's none of her damn business. Why, that's a matter of national security. And I guess if Congress really doesn't like it, they could pass a law against it. Or, you know, if they were really mad, I don't think she even says this, they could remove the president from office for such things. But far be it from her, as a federal judge, to rule that the Fifth Amendment is the Fifth Amendment and that the president is not authorized to violate it. Amazing. We talked about this... Yeah, I guess it did come out Friday because I talked about it with Todd Pierce on my show on, well, I recorded it Saturday and then played it on the KPFK show, Anti-War Radio, yesterday morning, Sunday morning on KPFK in LA. You can find that archive, or soon you'll be able to find it at scotthorton.org. And Todd Pierce, you might remember, he's a former JAG lawyer, defense attorney from the Guantanamo Bay charade. And he's actually got a new article. Well, he had one at Consortium News about we're all Cheneyites now. You might remember I was supposed to interview him last week, but his phone had phone problems. Remember that? Anyway, so here he is, though, now at antiwar.com with another new one, The Dark Side of Lieber's Code. And this was the code for the laws of war during the Civil War. And as he explains, it's the fountainhead of a lot of international law is based on the laws of war as defined by the Americans, and for good and for ill. And as he explains in there, with the advent of September 11th and the legal theories promulgated by the Bush administration and never really repealed, and in fact, kind of reinforced by President Obama since he's taken power, they have really put us on this this path of domestic martial law, you know, where the world is a battlefield and any pretension of the old rule of law is still just a pretension, that really they do have this unlimited authority. And now, I don't know, I wish I was better at the legal stuff so I could ask the better follow-up questions and all of that. Of course, the Congress passed a new law in the National Defense Authorization Act. I think it's Section 1021, he says, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, passed in late 2011, signed by Obama New Year's Eve 2012, which said that they can go ahead and give the Guantanamo treatment to you or me or anyone else they feel like. If you disagree with them, then you are objectively pro whoever they're in the middle of killing, and so you're on the other side. And, you know, disagreeing counts as an overt act to them. Now, on the other hand, so I guess where I get confused and caught up is the difference between what they assert is the inherent plenary authority of the commander in chief to do what thou wilt, compared to the power of the Congress to go ahead and pass whatever law legalizing whatever crime against the people or the Constitution that they feel like. And as we've seen, you know, there's really no law that can't be that's not enforced as law. And so if the Fifth Amendment says it's the Fifth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment doesn't say, you know, unless there's a pseudo half a declared war going on, then it doesn't say that. Fifth Amendment is the Fifth Amendment. That's what Todd Pierce says. He says the laws of war are alien to our Constitution. It does not provide for the laws of war to supplant it. Doesn't say that in there anywhere. And but anyway, they're now basically, and he makes multiple parallels to the theories of Carl Schmitt. Is it Carl? And the Nazis and the Fuhrer Prinzip, basically. The idea that the commander-in-chief is the law, he can do whatever the hell he wants, and what are you going to do about it? That's what I thought. That's basically what it is. And anyway, that's where we already are. Right? The only reason that they've got us, you know, we're kind of tranquilized on it. Nobody's upset about it because, at least as far as we know, they're not abducting Americans and holding them in Guantanamo-like military or CIA prisons. But then again, it's all secret, so we don't really know, do we? There was one federal judge that upheld the Hedges suit on the NDAA. And said that he does have standing, he and Ellsberg and others, they do have standing to sue because they have a reason to fear that this could be used against them. You know, Hedges is formerly a journalist who has interviewed, you know, actual, listed terrorists. And so has reason to worry. Well, a federal appeals court overruled her and stayed her injunction against the president because of his argument that, you know, they had appealed. The president appealed her decision and said no. He said in the signing statement, he promises never to use the military power to arrest you and hold you in Guantanamo or somewhere else, but he wants the ability to still do it. He didn't veto the law, did he? He didn't push for that part to be repealed. It's still there. And anyway, they're way the hell out of control now. The dark side of Lieber's code, Cheneyite jurisprudence, is what that's called. It's at antiwar.com today. And by the way, there's one. I should have called this guy. Peter Van Buren has one also about the arbitrary police state, and that is the no-fly list and all the people who are on the no-fly lists and can't get released from them for whatever nonsense, supposed technical reasons. All right. More unlimited power and government plotting and killing coming up on the show here in just a minute. Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right. So anyway, I'm sorry, man. I get off on too many tangents or whatever. All I was trying to say is that the Fifth Amendment is not the Fifth Amendment if a judge won't invoke it against the executive branch. It's not the Fifth Amendment if the Congress won't remove a president who violates it. And in this case, this judge jokingly referred to the hit on Alaki Jr., Abdulrahman Alaki, as a matter of national security, when the drone czar, now director of the CIA, John Brennan himself, says that that was a mistake. I'm not saying that that's true, but at least that's him declaring that it was not a matter of national security. It was a 16-year-old boy, an American citizen, born in Denver, Colorado, that they should not have killed. He claims did not mean to kill. All right, well, come on then. Sounds to me like Grandpa has jurisdiction, has standing. They murdered his grandson with a Hellfire missile. Nothing left but the back of his skull. But the judge said, I want to live a long life and make a lot of money and have a lot of power. And so I'm not going to cross Obama on this. Are you kidding me? Oh, and then she dressed it up in some legalisms. Because you see, there really is no law. Not really. There certainly is no Fifth Amendment. That's the one that says that they can't kill you unless there's been the due process of law. And, you know, they actually, I couldn't make this up for you. If I did, you'd say, you're a stupid, stinking liar, Scott Horton, and so I wouldn't try it. But no, it's really true that the current Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, actually gave a speech where he declared that if the president mulls something over, that that is due process. As Stephen Colbert put it, due process simply means that there is a process that you do. In this case, it's if the president feels like killing you and thinks that he should kill you, then you should be killed. There's your check and your balance. He's the cop, he's the prosecutor, the judge, jury, and executioner, Barack Obama. Now, George Bush claimed the power to torture you. And he said, well, you'll be protected if you accidentally torture somebody to death. But I don't think he outright said, go ahead and murder people. You know, kill them in a war sense. I don't know. I guess he did. Not American citizens, though. American citizens? It's not like it's okay to murder civilians in Yemen this way or that. But just in case TV didn't make a big deal about it for you, after your favorite primetime show, Barack Obama murdered a 16-year-old American-born American citizen who is in no way has never been accused of being a terrorist or sympathizing with Al-Qaeda in any way at all. Robert Gibbs, the president's former press secretary, but at the time he said this, he was just off the president's reelection campaign, I believe, was more or less still a spokesman for him. It's the closest thing to a real comment we got from the White House was, well, he should have had a more responsible father then. Well, Obama had already murdered his American-born, American citizen father. I think he was American-born, wasn't he, Alaki? He was certainly an American citizen, the father, I mean. 2 weeks before. So now that's Robert Gibbs' explanation that Obama was punishing this boy for being the son of a bad guy. And, of course, they never proved that Alaki was operational anything. I mean, they proved that he was a detestable son of a bitch who loved Al-Qaeda that had attacked the United States and killed 3,000 people. That he's, you know, openly supported them. But they've never proven, you know, openly, verbally, in spirit, supported them. With his speech, supported them. But they've never shown any evidence that he was actually a terrorist, that he actually was involved in plotting or planning or conspiring to do anything other than to put speeches on YouTube urging young American Muslims to fight. Which, again, is a good reason to, I don't know, charge him with treason and arrest him. Maybe, or I don't know, still free speech. They say that, you know, he was interviewed by Al-Qaeda for their magazine, but did they make him walk the line into the gang, or how do they do that? Was he actually an Al-Qaeda guy? If he actually was an Al-Qaeda guy, then he deserved a treason charge. Not a hellfire missile. And certainly not the murder of his son. And then imagine that. In the United States of America, Barack Obama, and this is unprecedented, right, where a president can just, where a president is claiming the authority to go ahead and murder American citizens in other countries. George Bush murdered an American in Yemen, but he swore he was trying to hit the other guy in the car, or five other guys in the car, and this American just, boy, he shouldn't have been tagging along with them, kind of an excuse. But in this case, Obama admits he's targeted Anwar al-Awlaki at the same time he killed a guy, Samir Khan, another American citizen, later killed his son. And a judge says, hey, hey, who am I to intervene in this? I'm just a federal judge here. It's not my, job to apply the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution to the executive branch. National security. Amazing. Oh, no, dude. Anyway, I gotta move on. I got so much more to cover here. I'm hoping maybe, I guess I'm not gonna get anyone from CCR. I'll try to see if I can get somebody else on the Alaki thing. I'll call Marcy during one of these commercials, y'all, and see if I can get her on to talk about it. Hey, let me talk about this real quick. Well, they had Afghan elections, and I just wanted to point out that the news on TV, their whole attitude is, look, they had an election and people showed up at it. Yeah, so what? They all just voted for their faction against whatever other factions. And as Eric Margulies pointed out on the show last week, the Pashtuns have no representation whatsoever except the Taliban insurgency. And they're going to keep fighting. The only question here is which on the list of handpicked sock puppets is going to come out ahead so that they can sign on the dotted line pretending to invite America to stay longer. What a sorry joke of a farce. Can you imagine if it was your son who had died in a war over there in Afghanistan for this mission to create a modern, diverse Western democratic nation state? Under that theory, anyway. And of course, especially it's worse when you find out what it's all really about is strategery. Redrawing the map the way we want it, pressuring Russia, pressuring China, blocking pipeline routes. What? Iran, Pakistan, and India want to work together on a pipeline, maybe even all the way to China, which could help prevent war for the long term in that part of the world? No way. We have to stop it if it's not our thing. Anyway, Afghan democracy is a joke. Anybody who believes in it is a damn fool. Give me a break. Afghan democracy. Oh, look, they held an election. Really? Of who against who? General Dostum, who likes to rape and kill people? skin them alive for fun. Running against lesser Dostums. CIA puppets like Abdullah Abdullah. Give me a break. Anyway, hey, moving on. Confirmation bias. No matter what happens in some kind of bogus election in Afghanistan, it'll never impress me. That's what we call confirmation bias. Or, flip-wise, if you really love it, and you love the empire, and you love glomming on to any slogan that they can give you to glom onto to try to justify all your warmongering, then look, a purple finger. It proves that you're right. Look, their fingers are purple. Even John Stewart, remember that? This wasn't confirmation bias. John Stewart in 2005, the election that started the horrible civil war that killed 1 million people, said, oh, look, their fingers are purple. Yeah. Well, anyway, actually, I'm going to skip confirmation bias. I'm going to get right back to confirmation bias. Maybe this is still under the subject of confirmation bias, maybe not. But I want to point out they're making a big deal out of the 20-year anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. And, of course, the only lesson TV can fathom about that is that America should have invaded. Bill Clinton should have invaded. But, you know, Black Hawk Down catastrophe had just happened, and he didn't care about that, and he didn't want to get bogged down in that. And so, forget about it, and all the Rwandans died. If only the heroic American Empire had deemed it worth their time to go and save the people. And I would say that is the wrong lesson. I mean, first of all, we should have open borders so that Rwandans who want to flee, who can come here. And we also ought to allow Americans who want to go and fight to save Hutus from Tutsis from Hutus. They ought to be able to do that if that's what they want to do too, and the government shouldn't stop them. But here's the thing about it. The real lesson of Rwanda is that when you topple a minority dictatorship that has been backed by foreigners all along for the purpose of being, you know, backing the minorities so that they stay perpetually dependent on you, when you topple them, don't just leave. Don't just stand there like an idiot, because you know what's going to happen? The majority is going to take their revenge. And you know who didn't internalize the lessons of Rwanda from 1994? That's right, anyone in America. Because all they can see is an opportunity to wage power lost. That's all they can see. And so what do? They go into Iraq, they topple the minority dictatorship, and then they stand around and or help the Iraqi Hutus eliminate the Tutsis. The Shia majority, long, and Kurdish majorities, long oppressed by the Sunni Arabs, waged a full-scale war with the U.S. Army as their auxiliary troops against the Sunni Arabs of Baghdad and the Anbar province and the Sunni Triangle for 8 years. Got 1 million people killed, most of those on the Sunni side. Because they couldn't internalize the lesson of Rwanda besides, aw, man, we could have moved our little toy soldiers around and blown some stuff up and we didn't take the chance to. Bummer. When the real lesson is the Dutch had propped up the Tutsis and helped them lord it over the Hutus for decades. And then they just up and left. And left the Tutsis high and dry. And the Hutus took their revenge. That's the lesson of Rwanda. Don't let these damned Democrats fill your head with anything else. Give me a break. And I'm sorry, I got confirmation bias and a lot more guns and all kinds of stuff coming up on the show next. Seymour Hersh. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And up next is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter, normally for the New Yorker magazine. The last couple have been in the London Review of Books. Welcome back to the show. Cy, how are you doing?
Okay.
Good, good. Very happy to have you on the show here. Lots to cover in very little time. I guess if you could, well, first of all, pardon me, let me go ahead and tell the people the latest article here at the London Review of Books is The Red Line and the Rat Line, your second on the sarin attack in Syria last August, and it's on Obama, Erdogan, and the Syrian rebels. So I guess, first and foremost, can you tell us about this all-important DIA report that you have apparently seen?
Well, the thing that's interesting about it, I did do an article for the London Review last about 3 months ago, mm-hmm. writing about the fact, the critical fact, that when the incident took place, when the terrible massacre took place with sarin, in the Ghouta suburb of Damascus, right away the American government immediately said the only possible person that could use sarin country would be Syria, and because nobody else has sarin. And the story I wrote 3 or 4 months ago said, no, there's been a bunch of reports that the government did not tell us about from the American intelligence community, saying that many of the opposition, most notably El Nusra Front, which is, I think, perhaps the most together radical, if you will, Sunni jihadist group there, they were the most largest number of soldiers, the most aggressive, or at least one of the most aggressive. They had sarin, and at that time, everybody, the White House denied it. There's no, and I said there was a paper to that effect, and they said no. So this time around, I actually had the paper, and the first sentence of this particular document, it was highly classified, like everything's highly classified. It was a very senior official in the Defense Intelligence Agency by DIA people. The first sentence that begins with this line: the El Nusra Front Associated Sarin Production Cell, that's a production cell for sarin, is the most advanced sarin plot since Al Qaeda's pre-9/11 efforts. We knew that Bin Laden was dabbling with nerve agent in the late 1990s, and we did some stuff to stop it. But anyway, there we are. So it goes on for 5 pages like that, talking a lot about Turkey's role in this, too. So it doesn't matter. I mean, the fact that I have a document, and I guess unless I publish it and expose my source to all sorts of trouble, the White House won't accept it. But that's troubling to me, that in a world where, you know, right now the reality is that the Syrian government has agreed to unilaterally get rid of its sarin stocks. It's a chemical warfare and sarin stocks. And if the intelligence is right, that will leave the only strategic weapon, you know, nerve agent can be a strategic weapon if it's used right, in the hands of the opposition. And God knows what they'll do when they get, you know, into a cornered, you know, they're losing that war. Anyway, it's just an amazing sort of head-in-the-sand approach my government has.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, On the case against the case that they have put forward, that it could only have been the Assad government, the Baathist government, that did it, what do you really have on that, aside from this DIA report saying that Nusra, I guess, you know, that predates the attack, that says that they had been messing around with sarin?
Well, I mean, the other thing that I'm writing about in great deal in this article is that within about 6, 8, 10 days of the incident, took place August the 21st, certainly by August 30th or 29th, our Joint Chiefs of Staff were made aware by the Brits, their counterpart, the British General Staff, senior commanding officers of the British Army, all armies, that the Brits had gotten a sample of sarin. They put it through their labs. They have an amazing lab at Porton Down. The Brits have been interested in chemical warfare like we have for years. And right now, their laboratories at Porton Down, it's in Wiltshire, is a lab that we also share, America and Brits share that lab for terrorist-related chemical and biological warfare threats. So we rely on it. So we know the lab is good. Their lab looked at the sarin right away when we got a sample, and it it was. We do know what the Syrian army's sarin looks like, because sarin's a very easily made a nerve agent. It's composed basically of two inert chemicals. One of them is an alcohol, and when you meld the two, when you put them together, you produce this terrible poison. The problem is that amateurs doing it produce what they call a kitchen sarin. It's not nearly as powerful as it could be. It's also very volatile. It's like water. It's very light and easily evaporates and could be dangerous to work with. In the advanced armies, our chemical corps and the Russian chemical corps, and most countries' chemical corps that are with a serious army, you produce additives, specially designed additives that you add to the mix for toxicity, for persistence, for safety and handling. And the sarin that was used in Ghouta, in the suburb of Damascus, did not have those additives. Therefore, it did not come from the Syrian army. This doesn't mean that something, you know, all we could say is that the sarin that was recovered was not from the Syrian army. It doesn't mean something strange could have happened. Some rogue Syrian army element could have broken away and made their own sarin. Doesn't mean the man in the moon could have done it, but it does raise a question about at this point, Obama had finally determined that the use of sarin, all those hundreds of deaths, crossed a red line. He said there was a year before he announced there was a red line that he would, if they crossed it with their use of chemical weapons, that is the Syrian army, he would act. And he decided that was it. And what I write about is the Joint Chiefs of Staff coming to Bashar and saying to him, the sarin doesn't work. It's not dispositive. And also, you have escalated the target package dramatically. And I write about this in some detail.
Wait. Hold on one second. First of all, I think you just accidentally called Obama a sod, so I want to make sure that we get that straight. But if I can go back to the Russian sample for just a second. I think, it's all over Twitter anyway, that it's a Russian sample, so how can you believe it? But it seems from your reporting here that the UK and the US governments didn't have a problem with the Russian origin of the sample.
Oh, my God. Don't forget, we and the Russians were pretty good allies in the 1990s. And when the Chemical Warfare Treaty went into effect in 1997, we pooled information with the Russians. And I can also tell you, I write about this in my article, it certainly did come from a Russian, it was delivered by a Russian source who was described to me by an American as somebody really solid, somebody we all knew, somebody we all trusted. This is not a game. We also had our own information about what was going on inside the Syrian arsenal. Believe me, the Syrian government would be more than happy to give a sample of any, because they were eager to have this looked at. Mm-hmm. So that's just, only in America. It's so funny, Scott. Only in America would you be oh, my God, Russian. The Cold War is still on.
Right.
It's really very strange. Yes, the Russians supplied the sample. They picked up a sample right away, a lot of samples. The British had absolutely no trouble with the provenance. They knew it came from Damascus. The British analyzed it. It was the British finding out of Port and Downs that convinced our army that we had to tell the president he doesn't have a case. Mm-hmm. I think the whole, if you want to run on with the Russians, go ahead.
Oh, no. I want to get to the military explaining to the president that he didn't have a case, because I think you were about to go there, also talking about the expansive war plan that was almost sounds like a poison pill. Like the military was saying, if you want us to do this, we're going to have to do it so big that you're going to want to not do it. But also, if you could answer about, I think you say in here that they, maybe not the military, but the CIA or someone else, kept their findings from Obama. They didn't want to tell him he was wrong blaming Assad.
In general, what the article said is, in general, the intelligence community is often reluctant to go to the president and say, sir, you're dead wrong about this. I mean, we saw that with the WMD.
Right.
I'll give you a better example. Did anybody tell Obama until the day it happened that he was in trouble with his computers on Obamacare? On the Affordable Act, Health Care Act? They were so obviously so reluctant to go to the boss with the problem that they actually had the problem explode in their face. Mm.
And so you're saying in this case, finally, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, I'll take care of it.
It isn't that it was a poison pill. It was that the White House had rejected the first package of 35 targets. They were targets, but they weren't devastating targets. Bomb a runway, so you had to take the trouble to fix it, punish them. But they wanted something, as I wrote, with more pain. And then they escalated. The next thing you know, the B-52s were coming into the act. And we're going to hit power nodes. We're going to go after the Air Force. We're going to go after airfields. In other words, by the time we were done, we were going to be flying what somebody said to me, a wonderful line, it's going to be the equivalent of flying close air support for El Nusra. You know, bomb and make it possible for a jihadist or a Salafist group Wahhabi to get into power? Are you kidding me? The Israelis would go nuts. So would the Iranians. My own guess is Obama was just as happy to hear it. I don't know that. Mm-hmm. He talked big, so did Kerry, but he certainly took the deal that was always on the table with the Russians. That deal was always on the table for unilateral disarmament. The Russians or the Americans, I don't know which one, maybe both, had talked about this a year earlier. Mm-hmm. Unilateral disarmament. We didn't do it. We weren't interested then, but we sure were interested after the visit by the Joint Chiefs. So I don't look at Twitter, Scott. So I don't know my kids have forbidden me to tweet.
Now I think it's already pretty widely reported in the Telegraph and in the London Sunday Times and other places about this rat line of weapons from Libya to Syria.
Well, but not the fact that there was an annex report to the not for the fact that it was a covert CIA operation that has not been reported.
Right. Oh, well, and the secret annex report to the Senate report, correct, I don't believe has been reported.
No, but and also that it was not briefed to Congress. Those are all things.
Right.
But go ahead.
The liaison. Yeah. But now, what I'm wondering is, you're saying
by the way,
that...
The New York Times also reported 2 years ago that the CIA was in Turkey moving arms. Again, not in the context that I had it, but certainly good reporting.
Right. And the Sunday Times had a thing about a ship that they were fighting over the weapons in it and all that.
Right.
But so what you're saying here is that after Ambassador Stevens was killed on September 11th, 2012, that the CIA called off their part of the gun running scam. And at that point, that was when Erdogan decided that he had to do something to ramp this thing up to. Because he was basically being left high and dry. Obama had said Assad must go, and I guess had at least implicitly promised the Turks he was going to see that through, and then he was changing his mind about that. So that was, I think you're saying, why Turkey decided to do this.
Scott, what you say is right, but I don't have Erdogan in there. I just know that after it happened, I think the rat line kept on going for reasons I don't know. Did Erdogan want to keep on going? It included money from Erdogan and the Saudis and the Qataris. We were basically nominally running it. The cover was it was covered by a British Australian group of all companies, so we could call it liaison. We didn't have to tell Congress about it. No, we didn't brief Congress on this operation, although you could argue we should have. Oh well, you know, you can go on forever with this thing. It's perfectly logical that the Turkish government was very upset and Erdogan was upset, but I just don't know it in terms of the rat line.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, but you're saying that this is when the Americans kind of quit. This is what motivated Erdogan to go ahead and cooperate, work with the Al Nusra Front in waging this false flag attack.
There's a lot of reason to think he was much more involved with them than we thought all along, because he is a little more fundamental than most people realize. He's gone quite a bit to the fundamental side in the last 10 years he's been in office, mm-hmm. and which has been a source of enormous problem there inside. You know, he's arrested many officers, and he's in a fight with his arch-rival Gulen, who lives here, over the fact that he's moved the country more towards away from being secular. Turkey always was a wonderfully religious state that was secular. It was, you know, privately Muslim, always Muslim, but secular. Mm-hmm. And he's moving it away, getting more religious. And so there's been a couple of articles in the Wall Street Journal about the head of intelligence, and a guy named Fidan Hakim, who is pretty very close to the jihadists there in Syria. And so it's certainly a complicated relationship. I can only do one more, Scott, because I got to be somewhere at 4 o'clock.
Okay, right. Yeah, I'm sorry for keeping you over
here.
No, but
don't
I guess,
be silly. Don't be silly. I enjoy talking to you always. But
okay, great. Well, I guess if you could just nail down for us your best evidence that it was really the Turks who were behind this attack.
Well, I don't think all I can tell you is that there are elements in the American intelligence community who all along worried about what was going on. All along, didn't think the White House had a good case. All along, were worried. They knew Syria, Turkey was deeply involved in supplying. The best guess you have is precisely what Turkey did. Nobody's saying we know Turkey. Turkey wasn't involved in throwing gas on the 21st of August. But Turkey and its army, its not his army, its MIT, its intelligence service, its paramilitary group, the police unit with some sort of paramilitary powers known as Gendarmerie, they were involved in trucking some of the supplies and chemicals into out of Turkey into Aleppo, where the jihadists have their base, and in generally helped train and look the other way as various al-Nusra groups were in Turkey trying to buy more of this stuff in large quantities of the precursor chemicals. And so there was a direct Turkey role, and we suspected as such. We don't think a Turkish soldier was there directing traffic or saying fire here. Mm-hmm. That was done by the rebels. But after the fact, as I write, we picked up an awful lot of noise, chatter, out of Syria with a lot of breastfeeding, and we did it. We finally did. But the whole world believes Sabar, they're enraged at Bashar Assad for doing this, and Obama's going to have to bomb now. And it didn't happen. But they wanted it to happen. That's what I'm saying in the end, that it's they believe, many elements of the community believed Turkey was deeply involved, even in the planning for this, but not necessarily involved in the actual operation.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
No problem, Scott.
Sure, appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. That is the great Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. Broke the story on the My Lai Massacre, of course, and author of Chain of Command, all about the Bush torture regime and many more. Here he is at the London Review of Books, The Red Line and the Rat Line. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Sorry, Liberty Stickers and whoever else's ad I skipped there. Let me see. Is this going to show me? Let's see. It should have been... The War State by Michael Swanson. Great book on the history of the origins of the Cold War, post-Cold War military-industrial complex, post-World War II. Cold War, military, industrial complex. Also, Liberty Stickers and the 10th Amendment Center and their anti-NSA project off now. Okay, good. All right, so, I'm Scott Horton. Coming up here in a few minutes will be our friend Ray McGovern, formerly a CIA analyst, and he's going to tell us all about his take on Seymour Hersh's reporting. He's pro it. Absolutely. I talked with Ray this morning, and he's going to have a lot to elaborate on here that I think you'll be very interested to hear. Okay, now, I meant to ask him whether Michael Maloof was one of his sources. The detractors are complaining that they assume that one of his sources is Michael Maloof. Now, even if that's true, assuming the guy can prove what he's saying with a document or something, then that's okay. Although, it's important to note that Michael Maloof worked with Douglas Feith in the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, which is a fancy name for saying these two jerks in a closet
making up lies about Saddam and Osama to try to get us into war with Iraq. It worked. And so that's why all decent people have a serious grudge against Michael Maloof, and that's why people ought to be suspicious of him. And that was on my list, is just last on my list, is least important question for him, really. I hardly think even the people who are assuming that Maloof was one of his sources, they don't seem to make the case that Hirsch's entire case hinges upon whatever source they think is him anyway, so who cares? So there you go. The only other part I didn't really get to ask him about was the President of the United States calling the Turks out over dinner. Erdogan wagging his, quote, effing finger in the president's face in the White House. Holy smoke. And Obama got mad, I guess, and said, not to Erdogan, but to Erdogan's head of intelligence, we know what you're up to with the extremists in Syria. We know what you're doing. Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, so I'll just tell you that Ray McGovern is going to have something to say about that that you're going to want to hear. What a strange, screwy world this is, man, I'm telling you. All right, Ray McGovern coming up on the show. All right. Oh, yeah. And you know what? Here, I'm gonna write it on my hand, too. So I try to remember to call Marcy during the top of the hour break and see if she will do the show re-Alaki killing. I don't know. Has she even been writing about that? See, man, it's not really fair to interview her about stuff that I ain't read her on it. Oh, you know what? It was Other Scott Horton said he could do the show, right? What did Other Scott Horton say? He's the perfect guy to ask about this. Other Scott Horton, where are you? Here you are. Next week. That's today. I'm going to call the Other Scott Horton and see if he can do the show. When I called the Center for Constitutional Rights today, I said, hi, I'm Scott Horton. And she said, oh, wow, hi. And I said, no, not the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, the radio show host. And she said, oh, sorry, I guess that happens to you a lot, huh? And I said, yeah, because he's a great man. I just happen to have the same name as him. I'm just some dude. He's a great man. Anyway, he'll be on the show. No, I'm going to call him and see if I can get him on the show. That's what I meant to say. All right, good. So I talked about Rwanda. Manning is appealing. Where does my email say that? Come here, email that says that. Where'd you go? Emma Cape, press coordinator. Chelsea Manning's legal team joined by government whistleblowers to discuss impending appeals. They are Thomas Drake and Mike German, NSA and FBI whistleblowers, respectively, will be giving a presentation all about their appeal on behalf of Chelsea Manning. Did I ever tell you what a hero Chelsea Manning is? What a hero. You know why America's not occupying Iraq anymore? Chelsea Manning. You know how they always try to do the thing where they hold a gun to a guy's head and they say, hey, sign here on the dotted line that says that you're inviting us to stay in your country forever, like the Japanese and the Koreans and the Afghans. Well, one thing that really helped Maliki say no and take a firm stand on that back in 2011 was some WikiLeaks came out about, you know, from the Iraq war logs right at the perfect time, November 2011, about a horrible American Army atrocity in Iraq where this entire family was executed at point-blank range. If your kids are listening, change the channel now. A one and a two and a turn your iPod back on. Including they executed a baby, as in under a year old baby, at point-blank range. And the entire rest of the family, too. Including other toddlers and young children. And then they called in an airstrike to try to cover it up. But the airstrike hit the wrong part of the house. And so the bodies were recovered by the local morgue anyway. And the Americans lied to the high heavens over what happened there all along. And then the war logs came out and proved that they knew they were lying all along. And this became the biggest deal in the Iraqi news cycle and helped Maliki to kick the U.S. the hell out of Iraq. Thank Manning. Also, you know, every time anyone mentions the IAEA and Yukiya Amano, especially in regards to the Iranian nuclear program, what do you always hear? What do you always hear? Well, it was revealed in the WikiLeaks that Yukiya Amano has no honor whatsoever. And apparently now neither do any of his ancestors have any honor at all because he's disgraced their name forever. I heard somewhere that's a big deal in Japanese culture, you know? In America, we've never heard of honor before. Not really. I mean, we dress up our aggression as honor sometimes, but not usually. Anyway, don't even bother usually. But Yuki Yamana, he has no honor. And it's admitted right there in the WikiLeaks entitled Yuki Amano, new head of IAEA, has no honor. Has sworn his allegiance to the American Empire and its lies in order to help them accomplish their agenda, whatever their agenda is. As he kissed the Americans' boots and promised to lie and promised to adopt their agenda as his own. What a tool. And you know why? They haven't gotten away with escalating their conflict against Iran as far as they wanted to earlier in the Obama years because of that. Robert Perry, who I still have a grudge against, Robert Perry has done a great job of writing that up recently about how that leak from those WikiLeaks cables about Yuki Amano and what a tool he is, what a willing servant. What a willing, dishonest servant of Western power he is. How far that's gone to undercut the Israeli and American hawks' position on Iran. And has helped to lead to a situation where we're now negotiating with Iran rather than bombing them. And there's a million more, right? There's a million more from the revelations about America's sock puppet dictator Ben Ali in Tunisia that led to the beginning of the Arab Spring, or cooperation with Eastern European nations and Thailand and Morocco and others on the torture program. Oh, all the pressure that the Bush and Obama administrations brought to bear on the Spanish to not indict the torture team of lawyers. On and on and on and on and on. There's a thousand of them. You know what? I have a list here. Manning's greatest hits. Whoops. Iraq, war crime 11. I just mentioned that. Iraq death toll. The Wolf Brigade torture and murder. The collateral murder video. The cover-ups of the Afghan escalation, the civilian casualties, the Iran war threat from Israel in 2007, the truth about Gaza, deliberately keep them desperate and hungry, on a diet but not starving, according to the Israelis, the pressure on the Spanish, the Guantanamo files, the Yemeni government covering up for the Americans on their airstrikes against Yemeni citizens, Tunisian corruption, Amano, Honduras coup, Ethiopia in Somalia, Washington lied about the Georgian invasion of Osetia of 08, Shell Oil in Nigeria. Chelsea Manning, American hero. Oh, shut up about your goddamn plane. Why don't you shoot yourself in the face to death? Please. I'm begging you now. So much for the top of the hour news. Here's some more news. The plane's still missing. We'll let you know when we find it. Al-Qaeda in Iraq attacks major targets in Baghdad. 42 kills, 74 wounded. Iraqi soldiers caught in a booby-trapped house. 20 of them died in that one. No, 15 were killed, 24 more wounded in a booby-trapped house. Boy, that Iraq war is just waged all this time because America started it. Oh, here's where I'll tell you about this confirmation bias thing here, man. Check this out. It's at Vox.com, How Politics Makes Us Stupid by Ezra Klein. He's the leader of the stupids. But anyway, point being that when it comes to politics, people believe whatever they want. And if you give them new and better information, it doesn't matter. People all people, especially liberals and conservatives, are fundamentally dishonest. And they're willing, all of y'all, except me, willing to break your spines bending over backwards in order to justify your previous positions, no matter how horrible. And you want to know why? You know what the number one reason for it all is? So you'll still fit in with your little social group. But all my friends are warmongers, Scott Horton. You're asking me to give that up? They'll all call me sissy and Obama lover, and I can't have that, so kill all the Somalis or whatever it is, right? It's a very rational decision. Don't you want to continue fitting in with your liberal or conservative friends? Of course you do, so go ahead and be horrible on everything, no matter what the truth is. It's at Vox.com, how politics makes you all stupid. Not me, though. I'm only right about everything, and all the evidence proves it. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, that's it. I can't stand this anymore. Welcome back to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show, FSN Radio News, notwithstanding. Why should I be patient for golf scores? Right. I can't think of any reasons either. So we move on to our next guest. It's the great Ray McGovern. For 27 years, he was a CIA analyst, and now he is the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. He writes at raymcgovern.com and at consortiumnews.com, and he will give a talk to your church group or whoever it is about why they need to be peaceniks and that kind of thing. Look him up there at raymcgovern.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Ray?
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing well.
Very happy to have you on the show. I know you've seen this brand new piece by Seymour Hersh. It's called The Red Line and the Rat Line. I just talked with him for about 20-something minutes about it, something like that. And I'll give you wide open berth here. You just tell us what you think you want us to know about this story, what you think of it, whatever details, and then I'll try to follow up from there. Does that sound all right?
Sure. First, Scott, I'd like to wax poetic, if I may, and borrow from Sir Walter Scott here, who started out saying, Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. But once we've practiced for a while, we markedly improve our style. I have composed that verse for John Kerry, John Brennan, and Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, who really are exemplars of practicing for a while. They markedly improved their style in lying, and now they have been exposed for the liars that they are and got us 1 inch, or maybe even a half of an inch away from war with Syria on the 1st of September of last year. It's quite a story. Hersh's got chapter and verse, and I'm really, really glad to hear that he gave you 20 minutes just now.
Yeah, me too. He's really great. And there are only a couple of questions I didn't really get to. I guess, first of all, I mean, what could be said about this is it's a circumstantial case. I guess maybe the first part of the circumstantial case is sort of something he saved toward the end, which is that the U.S. intelligence agencies, they just never really believed it at all. I mean, this is old news on this show. We've talked about from the very beginning, from your work and Gareth Porter's work, about how they didn't even release a CIA assessment. They released a government assessment that was written by the White House and was made to sort of sound like a CIA assessment. And then Phil Giraldi wrote in the American Conservative why exactly that was, and that was the threat of a full-scale revolt by the CIA analysts. They were going to all quit en masse, and you know, in a way that couldn't be publicly denied, at least. If they were made to go along with pushing this story. So we've kind of known that there were major problems with this all along. Maybe if you want to elaborate on that or get into the other, you know, parts of the circumstantial case here, you know, that at least it was not Assad and may well have been the Turks and in cooperation with the al-Nusra Front, who, after all, have sworn their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the good news, Scott. I mean, after my former profession of intelligence analysis was prostituted for the express purpose of deceiving our Congress out of its constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war on Iraq, that's as bad as it gets. And after that debacle, they got a couple of honest people in to run the analysis. Tom Finger did a very good national intelligence estimate on Iran and helped prevent a war against Iran. And now we see the analysts, who are still kind of devoted to telling the truth, believe it or not, rising up in arms and saying to the president and saying to General Dempsey, look, we're not going to do another Iraq, you know? And besides, John Kerry, you know, he may have been really good about steering boats up the Mekong, but he doesn't know anything about war. Otherwise, he would never speak of, quote, an unbelievably short war, end quote, in the Middle East. There ain't no such thing. So, Mr. President, Mr. General Dempsey, be aware that we intelligence analysts and our British counterparts won't stand for this anymore, and I don't care what John Brennan, the head of the CIA, says. You're going to hear from us if you perpetrate another war based on fraudulent, and they're talking mistaken, based on fraudulent intelligence. That's really good news. And, of course, Psy has a lot of that story. The even better news from the point of view of our movement, which we call Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, is that several of the insiders had enough trust in us to share with us what was going on. And so even before the president got bailed out by Vladimir Putin, of all people, and when he seemed to be still going for a vote in Congress, which likely is not, he would have won despite the growing opposition, we served up a memo to him in which we warned that this is what we're hearing from our insiders, and that there was all kinds of other evidence out there indicating that someone other than the Bashar al-Assad government was doing this, and that in any case we could tell him categorically that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, was saying untruthful things when he said 35 times on the 30th of August, We know it was Bashar al-Assad that ordered those chemical attacks. He didn't know. He doesn't know now. And I don't have to, you know, I don't have to kind of, what's the word? I don't have to kind of take it easy on this evidence. Tsai is very judicious, and he'll probably say, yeah, it's still all circumstantial. But it's a slam dunk for me, if only because the only people that had any incentive to start a chemical attack 2 days after the UN inspectors arrived in Damascus and with the red line that Barack Obama had foolishly drawn, the only people that have incentive to cross that red line and get the U.S. involved militarily were the rebels, who happened to be losing very bad at that point in time.
Right. Well, and I mean, the fact that his article could be Ray McGovern's reporting confirmed or something like that is, you know, I mean, this is what you already said was going on. And now he's coming in with more information, different information, but backing up what your sources inside the CIA were telling you last fall.
Yes, Scott, it's the way it works beautifully, really. You know, even when we were in the analysis division of CIA, we had current intelligence reporters, which was what I did, glorified journalists. You know, we would have to do this every day, and we did it with all the information we could gather, including very sensitive information. But, you know, we depended largely on researchers as well. And when you get one of the few investigative journalists left in this country, another prominent one, of course, is Bob Perry, for whom I write at ConsortiumNews.com. When you get a guy like Cy Hirsch, who revealed the CIA secrets of the 50s and 60s, who revealed My Lie, who revealed Abu Ghraib, I mean, when you get a guy doing the homework, sure, it takes him 2 months longer than it took us, but, you know, ours was, we were sticking our necks out. You know, we didn't really know chapter and verse. Now we do, and it's one of those rare situations where we feel, well, very lucky, but also very convicted that it is still our job to warn the president or to warn anyone else who will listen that he was being mousetrapped and really, really badly mousetrapped. And this business about a unbelievably short war out of Kerry's mouth was not only impossible, but it was a fraud because, as Cy points out, there was big stuff ready. There were the B-52s. They were going to, when the military does anything like this, they do it real big, okay? And we know from the reporting we had even then that the warehouses were being emptied, and it was just going to be sort of a mopping up campaign by the rebels to get rid of Bashar al-Assad after the U.S. had done not an unbelievably short war, but really done to Syria what we did to Iraq in March of 2003.
And, you know, in that case, it wasn't as obvious, at least to many, although Colleen Rowley and others had called it out. I'm sure you had talked about this, but in the case of the Syria war last summer, I mean, this was outright, as Dennis Kucinich called it, would have been America acting as al-Qaeda's air force. I mean, when every rebel group on the ground is sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, they just can't decide, you know, the order of rank on the ground in Syria and who's more loyal to him, maybe between the so-called Islamic Front, ISIS, and Nusra. All of these guys, as Patrick Coburn says on the show repeatedly, has said for years now, there's no real distinction between, you know, how bin Ladenite these forces are. They all are 100%. The only question is, you know, I'm not taking orders from you, pal, that kind of thing on the ground. But otherwise,
yeah,
that would be who's inheriting Damascus. If America B-52'd them out of power, that would be who wins the regime change, would be the suicide bombers.
Well, it would, you know, it would be up for grabs for a while. And, you know, the real people, you know, when you ask cui bono, who is this really supposed to benefit? Well, let me put it this way. Judy Rudoran, who writes for the New York Times, had an article just at about this time, and she had asked a very senior Israeli official, what's your preferred outcome of Syria? And he said, oh, that's easy, no outcome. And she said, I beg your pardon? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, no outcome. And we got the Sunni and the Shia at each other's throats, not only in Syria, but throughout the whole area. You know, to the degree they're killing off each other, you know, we're relatively safe. So, yeah, no outcome, please. Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because Bashar al-Assad's forces were starting to win. They drove the rebels out of chief rebel territory in July and August of last year. And so, you know, there was a lot of incentive for the neoconservatives in our country, Kerry among them, who really have trouble distinguishing between the strategic needs of Israel, as Israel sees it, and the strategic needs of the United States. They saw a big incentive to get in there with both feet militarily, so Bashar al-Assad wouldn't continue to win, and the thing would go on forever. Now, once the U.S. is in Scott, as much as the rebels, you know, are unalterably opposed to the United States, well, we can always gin up, you know, special forces squads and all, and can keep this thing going for years. And I think that's what the Israelis and the neoconservatives, including John Kerry, were aiming for, pure and simple.
Mm-hmm. And then so now let's go back to your reporting, the VIPS reporting here. Obama warned on Syrian intel at consortiumnews.com from last September the 6th. Where you talk about mm-hmm. plotting going on inside Turkey. Now, one thing that mm-hmm. you have in here that Seymour Hersh certainly doesn't write about is Americans, I think you say John Brennan's men, in Turkey as part of this conspiracy, or to what degree is part of this conspiracy to arm up al-Nusra with sarin?
Well, Scott, you always have to keep in touch with people, no matter how you know how reprobate they are. And that's the CIA operative's job. So the notion that there were CIA operatives with the folks among the rebels, the various rebel groups, and that they were kind of aware that this was going to happen and actually were in some kind of control of the warehouses where all these weapons were stored doesn't surprise me in the least. They're taking orders from John Brennan. John Brennan was in with John Kerry, like two peas in a pod, in trying to launch this war. We know that because our friends within the CIA told us that. So these people are keeping a watchful eye on what's going on. They're reporting back to Brennan, okay, and they're thinking that they're making him happy. It was the people on the other side of the CIA, the analysis division, who came through and said, "No, we're not going to do this stuff anymore. We're not going to dovetail the evidence. We're not even going to do a statement for you because it will never satisfy you." And that's why, as you correctly pointed out, we had a sui generis, a new genre of report. It was not an intelligence assessment. It was a quote government assessment mm-hmm. end quote, and we smelled a rat right away.
Right, yeah, I mean, I'm surprised they even tried that one, really. I guess they had to come up with something in a hurry, and it would be good enough for MSNBC and Fox, so why not, I guess, you know?
Sure, you know, and Kerry was dead set in doing this, you know. I have to say that, you know, next week I mark my 52nd year in Washington. Seen a lot of change, but I had never seen a situation set up this way where Kerry, 35 times, at the State Department in the afternoon of August 30 last year, says, "We know it was Bashar al-Assad. We know, okay? And we know that this president has a red line, and so we know we're going to have to retaliate." And everyone's talking about these cruise missile ships that we have in the Mediterranean. And within 22 hours, the president gets up in the Rose Garden, and he says, "The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has told me that we're in position to strike Syria, but we don't have to do it today. We don't have to do it tomorrow or next week or next month. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to ask for congressional authorization to do this." Wow. I was outside the White House at the time. We were shouting, "Hands off Syria," right? We were incredibly surprised and really, really happy about that. Now, why did that happen? That happened because General Dempsey was in receipt of this honest assessment from the British that sarin was not from Syrian government stocks, okay? And our guys in the CIA were protesting that they weren't going to fool around with the intelligence anymore, and they'd be held to pay if they started a war and our analysts decided to seek an opportunity to tell the real story. So the president, to his credit, I suppose, changed his mind within 22 hours. Now, what did that mean? That meant that he had to call the Israelis or have somebody call them and say, "Look, we're not going to do it. You can relax your defenses." And then he had to call the French. You know, "Turn off the engines on your fighter bombers that you have on the tarmac. We're not going to do it." Now, that took a lot of guts and a lot of... Now, who helped him out on that? Did John Kerry? No way. John Kerry's in Europe, and he's coming back, and somebody asked him at a press conference, "Now, Secretary Kerry, is there nothing at all that Bashar al-Assad can do to avoid being hit militarily by the United States forces? And Kerry says, well, I mean, he could give up all his he can give up all his chemical weapons, but that's not going to happen. He's not going to do that. Okay. 2 hours later, when Kerry's in the plane going back to Washington, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, gets up and says, I think the Syrians are willing to destroy all their chemical weapons. And sure enough, Syrian foreign minister gets up 2 hours later and says, yeah, we'll do that. Who bails the president out? Vladimir Putin. And it's clear, and I see that Sy includes this, that Putin and Obama had been talking about all this behind Kerry's back, trying to work this thing out with the chemical weapons. And by the time they made this agreement, they had working groups already working on it. And so it was concluded in record time. Within 3 days, they had this agreement. And then, you know, the rest of the story. No war. The chemicals destroyed. Putin saving the president. Now, as you probably remember, Scott, I come from the Bronx, right? And we used to watch Gene Autry movies all the time, right? And you know, he would get in trouble with what they call the Iroquois Indians, okay? And they used to have real, you know, terrible things they do to Gene Autry. And this one time, this commentator was saying, you know, here's another film, and these Iroquois Indians, they hate Gene Autry so much. They hate him from another picture. They hate him from the movie last year. Okay, that's how the neocons hate Vladimir Putin. He bailed out our president. They didn't get their war, and that explains in large measure why they wanted to create this distrust, this animus between Moscow and Washington, which we haven't seen a like of for many decades. That's why, even if they failed in Ukraine, which they did, the consolation prize is this enmity that they've sown between Putin and everybody else. Putin, no shirt on, bad Putin, bad, bad Putin, no shirt, rides horseback, bad, bad Putin. it's ridiculous.
Okay, now here's the thing. I just take it for granted, actually, at this point, that could really hamper and will probably really hamper any effort of the Americans to work with the Russians to try to end the violence. Like you said, they don't really want that anyway. And if the pressure was ever on them to do it, this could really help sabotage it. I'd put money on it that the war in Syria, that America and Russia will not see eye to eye on Syria and really resolve the fighting there anytime soon, and partially because of this. But so my real question then is, what about the Iran nuclear deal? I mean, the center, most at least, the majority of the American establishment, they're really behind Obama on this, and they really do want to have a final nuclear deal. And it ain't the Russians making the Iranians do this anyway, right? And so do you think that this will really be a problem with the upcoming nuclear deal?
I don't, Scott. I don't see Russian interests diverging very much from American interests on this. And, you know... Okay, it might be the first time, but Obama is showing some backbone on this one, you know? I mean, so let's give him a break and say, well, maybe he's got enough backbone to see this thing through. He certainly has pretty adroitly arranged the forces in Washington so that, you know, Congress isn't breathing down his neck too much on sabotaging these things. But their potential for sabotage is great, and so is the Israeli potential for sabotage on this. And the first time this all was going to be worked out, at the end of Obama's first year in office, October of 2009, there was an attack on Revolutionary Guard generals in southern Iran, killed five of them, okay? By what group? Well, it was a group called Jundallah, who has been sort of set up, financed by the Israelis, by the U.S., sometimes by the PACs. And how did they get that expert intelligence to kill five Revolutionary Guard generals in this outpost? Well, I don't know how they got it, but they screwed up the talks. Those talks were supposed to start the next day in Vienna, and the Revolutionary Guards guys went to the Supreme Leader, to whom they report, and said, hey, you're going to deal with these perfidious Americans when they just, when they and their friends, the Israelis, just took out five of our generals? And that put the kibosh on that thing. for a whole year until it was resurrected by the Brazilians and the Turks, and they had a deal, and that was scuttled by Hillary Clinton.
Well, we came to find out later that those Jundalla, at least that time around, if not, you know, back in the Bush years, at least that time around, Jundalla had been hired by Mossad posing as CIA. Or did you ever confirm that story from foreignpolicy.com?
Well, I didn't take the trouble to try to confirm that with my friends, but it's entirely plausible.
Yeah, that was actually...
So all I'm saying here is that there are all kinds of ways to derail this thing. I think Putin is not going to be the guy to derail it.
And, you know, it's funny that those of us who know that Iran's nuclear program is nothing to worry about are the ones most obsessed with getting this nuclear deal, just because we want this red herring out of the way and you know, hopefully can, you know, start forging a peaceful relationship. But I hate to make it sound like it's really an emergency, that something needs to be done about what Iran is doing.
On its face, Scott, you know, what we're saying is... We're not going to deal with you Iranians until you stop working on that nuclear weapons program that we know you stopped working on 10 years ago. So you better stop it.
Yeah. Well, or the one that, as Gareth Porter's shown in his new book, never existed 10 years ago or 20 either.
Yeah, that's a great book, The Manufactured Crisis, and it's an incredibly apt title.
Yeah,
purely manufactured. It's quite remarkable how, if you read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, you never ever see the notion that the U.S. Intelligence Committee at the end of 2007 said that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. Right. And if my arithmetic is correct, that's more than 10 years ago.
Right. Yeah, that's the worst case scenario, that they haven't worked on it since then. All right. Well, you know what? We're already pretty much out of time. I know you got to go a little bit early here, so I'll go ahead and let you go. But I'll thank you very much for your time on the show today, Ray.
You're most welcome, Scott. Good
luck. I
hope we
can talk again. In fact, I'll probably call you in a day or two to catch up on Ukraine, too, because there's a lot going on there still. All right. Thanks.
There is. Mm-hmm.
All right, everybody, that is the great Ray McGovern. He's at raymcgovern.com. You can also find him at consortiumnews.com. And so you heard it, his stamp of approval on what Seymour Hersh has written here in the London Review of Books, The Red Line and the Rat Line, Hersh, on Obama, Erdogan, and the Syrian rebels. Oops. And, you know, by the way, I keep hearing people say that, well, you know, the al-Nusra Front, they're the al-Qaeda guys, and ISIS, they're so bad that the al-Qaeda guys don't even want to have anything to do with them anymore, and they're at odds. Well, that's actually really not right. The al-Nusra guys are just as bad as the ISIS guys, bad in terms of murdering innocent civilians, shooting, you know, juveniles in the face for not even half taking Allah's name in vain kind of nonsense, suicide bombing schools full of women and children, cutting their prisoners' heads off, and all this madness. They're madmen. Just as bad as ISIS. The fight is not that, oh, Nusra's okay and ISIS are the ones who are beyond the pale. ISIS is only beyond the pale to Ayman al-Zawahiri, who I didn't think was a spokesman for the West about who's good and who's bad. And the only reason that ISIS has fallen out of favor with him is because he wanted them to go back to Iraq and fight in Iraq and leave the Syrian battlefield to the al-Nusra guys, which was bad politics. It was too much for him to ask, and so it blew up in his face and made him look like an idiot and helped split these groups. But that's all. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Yeah, sometimes I like to let the music play for a minute. All right. Well, so, did you ever notice how I'm right about everything? I know. It's a confirmation bias. As long as your bias is the same as mine, then we're all good. Here's me being right. Mother Jones has come out with an old video of Rand Paul blasting Dick Cheney and saying that Dick Cheney's motive for the war in Iraq was to make money for Halliburton. I think that's got a hell of a lot to do with it, in fact. He didn't say blood for oil. If anything, he was talking about army contracts for Halliburton to build bases and tear them down and rebuild them again and all of that kind of crap. You know, maybe build a pipeline here or there for the Kurds or something, but that's certainly not the same as saying war for Exxon, necessarily. They did want regime change there, but not like this. Oh, man, who hired Richard Pearl to decide what to do? Oh, no. Anyway, it's a great clip, and Rand Paul's making a great point in the clip. It's a few years old here, and he's saying, I'll just sum it up for you or whatever, the part that's got him all riled up. He's quoting Dick Cheney from that famous AEI interview where he's justifying why they didn't go all the way to Baghdad in 1991. And oppose Hussein then. And he says, well, the Syrians would have gone and run off with the fighting Sunni part of the country, and the Shiites would have spun off to Iran, and we don't know what the hell would have happened with Kurdistan, and we'd have been occupying Baghdad and bogged down for years, and maybe we wouldn't even be able to find Saddam, you know. And it's like, oh my God, there is no one more prescient about the disaster of the invasion of Iraq than Dick Cheney himself. But then, as Rand Paul points out, it was after that that he went to be CEO of Halliburton. And what good was he for Halliburton? He didn't know anything about being an oil man, not really. I mean, they say, you know, worked for Brown & Root in Wyoming long ago or whatever, but that doesn't mean he had any kind of chops to be CEO, other than he was the former Secretary of Defense and formerly a congressman, and the Halliburton Board of Directors thought, let's get on welfare. Forget building pipelines for companies that need them. Let's get jobs building and tearing down and rebuilding bases for the military. You know, like Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo. You know what? Are you in front of a computer right now? You've got a computer in your pocket right now. Go type in for Google Images Bondsteel, like James Bond and, you know, iron and other metals in alloy form. Bondsteel. Camp Bondsteel. And go look at that. That was from the 1990s. That was just a taste of the money to be made. And so, and then also, of course, Dick Cheney, being a lifelong nationalist, collectivist, statist, doesn't know a damn, oh, public servant, doesn't know a damn thing about economics or how to run a business. You know, Mr. Deficits Don't Matter, Dick. Doesn't know how to run a business at all. And so what he did, one of the things that he did was he bought a company that was like 2 days away from being found responsible by in a civil junction for hundreds or at least tens of millions of dollars. I think it might have been hundreds of millions of dollars in asbestos damage claims going back decades. And Cheney bought this company right on the eve of their annihilation by the court. And the demand that they turn over all this money. So, a really, really bad business decision. That was just one of them that he made as a head of CIA. Oh, I'm off on a damn tangent. I just hate Dick Cheney so much, I like talking about how much I hate him. The point is, Rand Paul used to not be too afraid to say something like that. And Mother Jones, because they're evil liberals and they want to fight on the right because they figure, hey, this will weaken the right, and won't that be good? It's not like they put peaceful principle first, really, you know? They just want to see a fight. So, okay, fine by me, whatever. Partisanship's fine. I told them, please, please, please continue to find clips of Rand Paul being good on things. Because I, too, just like Mother Jones, I want to see Rand Paul fight with those in the Republican Party who would destroy this country forever were they to get the chance again. These torturers, these liars, these warmongers, these naked imperialists who would bankrupt this country, who would destroy this country, who would torture people to death. in the name of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and our freedom. I want Rand Paul to fight. And here's the thing. I don't think he's up to the task as well as his father in terms of his core principle or in his real knowledge. On the other hand, he's a lot more of a fighter than his father. His father's such a dear, nice old man. And Rand is kind of a snotty little jerk. Well, okay, that's good. I'm kind of one too. I can see the value in that. I would, in other words, if you make him fight about it, he can win. He can tangle. Go ahead and fight with Dick Cheney. You shouldn't have to give in to the war party on anything. Guess what? They're wrong about everything. Go ahead and fight them. Why suck up? Why give in on Iran sanctions? Why give in on staying in Afghanistan? Why give in on global basis? Why give in on any part of the right wing's disastrous, naked imperialist foreign policy? Go ahead and fight them and win. You can't be president if the people don't agree with you anyway. Lead them. Lead them. The American people already agree anyway, really, with the foreign policy. You just got to crystallize it and tell them, yeah, I'm the guy who will implement the leave the world the hell alone foreign policy that you people want. This parade is already forming. Go ahead and get at the front of it now. And then, give me a break, John Bolton? Liz Cheney? Jennifer Rubin? Man, if you can't just dispense with these people and turn them into notches on your staff at a moment's notice, then you ain't no good, can't be president anyway. Get in there and fight with them. You know, I've Googled, man, there's just too much damn footage of Rand Paul. I can't find it. Maybe chat room guys can find it. Maybe Twitterers can find it. But there's footage. I think it's at an outdoor kind of barbecue sort of thing from 2008 or 2009. Where Rand Paul's explaining about the causes of suicide terrorism and defending his father from the Giuliani attack and saying that, yes, in fact, American foreign policy existed before September 11th and it helped precipitate the attack. It's hilarious today, the way Jennifer Rubin puts it at the Washington Post. She says, he has defended his father's remarks that U.S. foreign policy precipitated 9/11. Parentheses, although Rand Paul says this didn't justify the attack. She is such a liar, dude. Jennifer Rubin, could she tell the truth about anything? I mean, she's right that Rand Paul says it didn't justify the attack, but her implication is that Ron Paul never made such distinction, that Ron Paul somehow had said that we deserved it. What a lie. You see what I mean, conservatives, about how much your leaders detest you, how little respect they have for your intelligence? They think that you can't just look up Ron Paul on YouTube and see how many hundreds of thousands of, or hundreds or thousands, I guess, to be literal about it, maybe even thousands of times that he has said that, no, this doesn't justify what they did at all, attacking and killing civilians. I'm just trying to explain to you that the reasons that they said that they were doing what they were doing. And if we ignore their motive, then we ignore their motive at our own peril. Doesn't quite sound like he's taking the side of Osama there, does it? But Jennifer Rubin would lie to you. Jennifer Rubin would call you a stupid idiot right to your face. Hey, you stupid idiot. At least Rand said that, you know, it's not like it was justified. And imply and leave you to puzzle, huh? I guess she's saying that Ron Paul said that America deserved that? And then what's funny is she goes on to call it all conspiracy theory, this and that. His father's conspiratorial view. They're trying to attempt to imply that Ron Paul thinks that the American government did the attack. When she just got through smearing us saying that, smearing him, saying that he said America deserved the attack. She can't make up which lie she's trying to push for at any given moment. And this is a guy that Rand Paul, thus far, has just tried to suck up to and compromise with. Oh, I can't have Liz Cheney, same difference. I can't have
Jennifer Rubin attacking me for voting against Iran sanctions. Oh, no. I better vote for those. But why? How much respect did it buy you? Nothing. Anyway, I just want to see a fight. You know, Ron Paul is much more libertarian, but then again, he stutters a lot more. And he was only in the House of Representatives, and one out of 435 in the House. That's it is what it is, but it is what it is. Rand Paul's one of 100 in the upper house. He's there for 6 years. He's younger. He still has brown hair. You know, he's young. And he is, you know, a contrarian, not just like in a principal point of view, but, you know, he likes arguing about stuff. So, in other words, I'm just saying the difference between how he is and how he could be is so vast. How awesome Rand Paul could be if he would just, you know, push his Bentons aside and just go ahead and be as libertarian as possible. It ain't like his dad is wrong. His dad is right on all this stuff, especially on the foreign policy stuff. There's no reason in the world he should have to compromise on this foreign policy stuff. He should be leading, you know? And anyway, I don't know. And he's right that Dick Cheney's a criminal. And I think it's hilarious that John Bolton and Jennifer Rubin and all them are so upset about this. I want more. Anyone who's got footage of Rand Paul being good a long time ago on anything, go ahead and forward it to Jennifer Rubin. Let's go ahead and have this fight. Go ahead and forward it to John McCain, the centrist liberal Republican, who's never met a war that he didn't want to put his someone else's kid's boots on the ground in his whole life. I say go ahead and fight. I don't know how, you know, Rand could possibly lose the argument, at least. He's a senator. He's got the access enough to the media to wage his fight. And if he took the libertarian position, he would be right. And therefore, he would win. Especially against Liz Cheney. Come on. You're not scared of her, are you? Jennifer Rubin? John Bolton? I say bring him on. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So here, let me wrap up the show with some things for you here. I'm sorry I didn't get any experts on about the Alaki case today. We'll catch up on that. They will cover up. We will catch up. All right, so listen, let me get back to this thing here. Chicago's newly armed residents send murder rate plummeting. So the court had struck down the concealed carry bans in Illinois as the last state in the union to legalize concealed carry with a permit. And is it really the last one? It's amazing to me all 50 states have finally legalized it. That's great. So, and then now they're saying the lowest number of homicides since 1958. Now, here's the thing about that. I'm totally for gun rights and completely and totally against opposition to gun rights and any gun control laws really of any description. I'm more pro-gun than any gun nut in the whole wide world. Not that I'm really a gun nut. I'm just a gun rights nut. And I really mean it. And so, this story confirms my bias. See, if criminals know that the neighborhood is helpless before them, then they'll do what they want. If they know that actually everybody may well be carrying a 45, they start behaving a little bit more politely. All right? I already think that that's right. I've already read More Guns, Less Crime years and years back, and I think that there's statistical evidence makes that case that I bought at least back then, too. So it extra double confirms my bias and my prior information that I've already got. But here's where I'm really going with this. First of all, I'm going to admit here that crime rates have fallen all over the country, everywhere.
and maybe Chicago's last or something. Maybe this has nothing to do with the guns at all. Everybody likes to make a causation wherever there's correlation, wherever there may or may not be a real lesson to be found. And so my point is to get back to this here. This article at Vox.com, How Politics Makes Us Stupid. So let me just explain for you real quick what they did here. They give you an equation. They give you an experiment. They say people had a rash, and then we give them some... They don't really do a rash. They're just making up the story to test on people. They're saying how effective this skin cream is on people who had the rash. Now, the people who the rash got better... It was a higher number of people. The people who the rash got worse, it was a higher percentage of people it made the rash worse. But so you have to be able to stop and think about it for a second. Aha, you're trying to trick me with the math here. Even though the raw number is higher of the people who it helped them, the percentage is higher for the people that it didn't. Now, anyone ought to be able to figure it out. And anyone can. It's basically a pretty consistent percentage of people who are basically the more math inclined, who stop and really reason through it and get the answer right. Okay, so that's sort of the control experiment. But then, so they do a test about global warming and about guns. And they give, and it doesn't matter whether they're telling the truth or not. That's not the point of the experiment, right? They do it both ways. They say, here's some information that says that global warming is a bunch of nonsense, or here's a bunch of information that says maybe it's a bigger worry than you thought before or whatever. And then they say, here's a study that says more guns equals less crime, and here's a study that says more guns equals more crime. Right. So it doesn't matter whether those studies are right or not. What matters is what do people make of them, and what people make of them is whatever they want. And so where on skin cream, nobody really has a bias and nobody really cares. Those who are more mathematically inclined tend to get that one right. And people who aren't, they just kind of get fooled by the trick question sort of a thing. Right. Well, when it comes to telling a liberal that actually, here, the study says that if you legalize gun ownership by regular people, that drives the crime rates down, they will absolutely refuse to internalize that. And you'll have to go through and read the percentage points and whatever. But it's absolutely out of control, the numbers of people who the percentages and all that, of people who absolutely will, you know, refuse to be swayed by the evidence. Now, there are other things here too, which they're not, and then they blame it mostly on people fitting into their social group and not wanting to change an opinion, that they value holding that opinion less than the relationships it might cost them were they to change it. That kind of thing, right? Like, it's not in my interest to start being pro-gun control, no matter what new information I get, because I'm a libertarian and I'm against gun control in principle, and I don't really care what evidence you say you have about. And in fact, even if you show me that increased gun ownership leads to increased crime, my answer is still tough, because my policy doesn't bend based on a fact like that, because my policy is that people are individuals and every individual has a right to defend their life up to and including using lethal force if it comes down to it, to protect themselves from someone else. And so damn your statistics anyway. Same thing with global warming. If you show me global warming is a big deal, I might believe you that it's a big deal if you can convince me it's a big deal. But I sure am biased against it, because I know that the government wants me to believe it's a big deal, whether it is or not, because they want to exercise power over me and my money and yours too. And if they can use global warming, oh my God, the weather, as their excuse to tax the hell out of you and ruin your life, they will. And I would rather that you ruin your own life with your own money and have them leave it to you. So that's kind of, my libertarian take on this. But, you know, the study is really about liberals and conservatives. And liberals and conservatives, they don't really recognize things like sacrosanct individual rights. For them, if it's a matter of policy, it's a matter of policy. What should be done about global warming? I guess it depends on how big of a crisis it is. If it's actually a crisis, then maybe something should be done about it, would say the conservatives, right? or if guns really cause more crime, maybe there should be gun control. And that's why they won't concede on the evidence, because then they would have to change their mind about what should be done, and then they'll be way outcasting themselves from their group. Is that a verb? Can you outcast yourself? They will be casting themselves out from their in-group if they change their mind. And same kind of thing with liberals who just, you know what I mean? Can you imagine being a liberal in a group of all liberal Democrats, but all of a sudden you're the only one who's for the right of every man to own an AK-47 if he wants? Ooh, how gross. And out of the group you go. Now you're going to have to go find a new group of friends because they're just not going to be able to deal with that kind of thing. In my case, I don't argue politics with my family. Boy, if I get into it at all for even 1 second, I realize that, man, I should have just kept my mouth shut. Just don't. It ain't worth it, because my in-group, my family, is way more important to me than anybody's opinion about politics that doesn't have to do with my family, right? So I hope you would take that same advice and not ruin your family relationships over stuff like this. I know people do sometimes. But that's just one example of where I just censor myself, right, and just whatever, try to go on. But it's the same thing writ large, too. So anyway, I think this kind of stuff is interesting. I took psychology and social psychology class in junior college. In fact, as I learned it in psychology class or social psychology class, as attitude inoculation. How can I protect myself from psychological manipulation, particularly by those with power? And if I can learn all the scams and all the different ways that they try to influence my and other people's views, then maybe I can try to immune myself from their manipulation, you know? So I always took a big interest in, you know, how easy it is, how shamefully easy it is to manipulate people into believing what you want them to believe. In my experience, of course, it's not easy at all. But I guess that's because I just try to work with honesty and the facts as best I know them rather than trying to manipulate people. But, you know, I learned, for example, and they do these studies. It's not really science. It's pseudoscience. But, you know, they do the study over and over and over again. And what they found is if they're trying to convert you to, say, like a right-wing John Bircher, or if they're trying to convince you, convert you to left-wing environmental activist, and say you're just Joe Sixpack out there or whatever, they invite you to a political meeting. They show you a video about environmental activism or about the United Nations or whatever it is. If they feed you peanuts, you'll be 54% more likely to join the group at the end. And if they feed you jelly beans, you'll be 64% more likely to join. I mean, that's how it works, popcorn or whatever it is. And then they do the experiment over and over and over again. And they find that salty snacks are really good for getting people to join your political group. But sugary snacks are even better. That's how you can tell the difference between a liberal and conservative. Yeah, right? Mike and Ike's versus Mr. Peanut. They're kind of shaped the same, but it's different. Anyway, I like that stuff. How politics makes us stupid. It's a bit overdone, this piece, but it's interesting. It's at Vox.com, which I guess is Ezra Klein. And who's Ezra Klein? He's the guy from the Washington Post. I guess Vox is his new thing. But he's the guy from the Washington Post who's made himself famous as a policy-only guy, right? No principle. It's all facts. It's all science. The science of forging a perfect society through the power of the national government and applied technocratic principles of human action. That's what he stands for. He's like the boss on that movie Brazil. Nah, maybe not. Maybe he's one of the worker bees. He believes in the system there big time. Anyway, interesting piece here, how politics makes us stupid. You and me included. Especially you. No, especially me, I admit. All right, I don't know. All right, what time is it? Oh, no, I almost got to go. I only got 30 seconds, so I better hurry up and say a thing. Oh, man, I didn't get a chance to talk about this. I'm sorry, guys. You got to read this. It's at the Washington Post. Get this. I mean, you won't be surprised, but still look at it, okay? It's really worth looking at because there are a few different points that I won't have time to make here. But you'll laugh. It's the less Americans know about Ukraine's location, the more they want the U.S. to intervene. And in fact, the less they know about Ukraine at all, the more they want America to intervene. Hilarious the way they got the little purple dots where everybody clicked. Isn't that great? That is just beautiful. All right, yeah, that's at the Washington Post. The less Americans know about Ukraine's location, the more they want the U.S. to intervene. That's at their website, WashingtonPost.com. And that's it for the show. We'll be back tomorrow with more great interviews and news and things like that. Thanks for listening. See you.